We are now recording, and this is Out Now with Aaron and Abe. I am Aaron, and Abe is not here. But anyway, Out Now is a film podcast where Abe and I normally discuss New Movies Weekly. However, every now and then we have these special bonus episodes, whether it's one of our fun commentaries or something completely different. And this is one of our fun commentaries. This is our September 2016 commentary episode. Because you guys like the commentary tracks, so we do one once a month. And this month, we are talking Denzel Washington in Fallen. That should be the whole title. It's not. It's just Fallen. But it's the it's one of three 1998 Denzel Washington movies. And probably the one that... The Siege is probably worse than Fallen. We generally like Fallen. We'll talk about these movies. Because he had a good year in 98. He had a good career in general. We'll get into all of that and more while we talk the supernatural thriller featuring Denzel Washington and John Goodman. Fallen. But first, joining us to discuss Fallen, time has always been on his side. From Forbes, Scott Mendelson.
Always a pleasure to be back, and I'm a big fan of The Siege.
All right. And from Why So Blue and the Cult Cinema Cavalcade podcast, he likes to tell you about that one time he almost got defeated. It's Brandon Peters.
Hello. Happy to be here talking about Fallen. You stole my line. I was like, I'm going to come here with, I want to tell you about the time I almost podcasted, but, well...
In one form or another, we all got it out. How are the two of you doing tonight?
Excellent.
Fighting a cold, but I'm good.
All right. Good to hear. You made it onto this podcast, so that seems like a good step right there. And yeah, we're gonna talk about Fallen, and we're gonna jump right into it. So how this works for those of you that don't listen to our commentaries have before, and for some reason you're like, this obscure Denzel Washington movie is the one I should start with. Welcome. I hope you enjoy.
There will be spoilers. Too bad.
There will be spoilers, yes. So if you've never seen Fallen, but you're like, I need a podcast to listen to while I watch Fallen, you've come to the right place, apparently. But yeah, basically, Scott, Brandon, and I all have the movie Fallen paused currently at about 13 seconds in. This is if you're watching the movie with us while listening to this. So if you are doing that, we have it paused 13 seconds in at the Warner Brothers logo, where in 1998, apparently it was 75 years of Warner Brothers. So this is like a logo that says 75 years entertaining the world. We have it paused right where that's fully formed on here. So you can pause it right there, and then I'm going to count from 3, 2, 1, go, and we're all going to press play at the same time, and those of you listening will be able to hear us have all kinds of things to say about this movie while following along with the film. For those of you that are just listening, just to listen, good on you. Have fun with that. Enjoy going on your jog or your drive or whatever you're doing while listening to us talk about Fallen, and we're just going to press play and get this thing going. So you guys ready?
Yeah.
Ready.
Okay. 3, 2, 1, go.
Fallen!
That's how Spawn started, too. Turner picked. Yeah. Look at that logo. I haven't seen that one in a while.
Ah, some okay, 90s so, font?
Yeah, we get the 90s. We get 90s
occult font.
A cult font, yeah, for like movies like Seven and like The Craft, I assume probably has font like this.
You got me closer to God.
Yep, a lot of crosses too so far. So as we're getting started here with the title sequence and the
Aaron, what are my two least favorite things in movies?
I know.
No. This is an exception to the rule.
Yeah,
my two least favorite things are medias res. Mm-hmm. Where you arbitrarily start a suspense thriller or a tense drama in the middle or the end of the film, which operates as a giant spoiler. And I also loathe overly expository voiceover, with the exception of Fallen, which is literally the one exception to the rule, where I love how this film uses both things.
This is back in the day where this narrative device wasn't getting abused, though.
True. Aaron Sorkin and Alias kind of ruined the media res because they did it all the time.
I remember the point where I just was like, okay, I'm getting tired. It was Michael Clayton. It was like, I don't know, for some reason I felt like there was too much of it going on at the time.
Oh, but something. Michael Clayton's awesome.
It is an awesome movie, but I was like, man, this could have been like burned out on this device, but.
I could see that, I guess, but I feel like that serves the narrative because you want that. I think there's a call for having something like that. It's like, how does one get, because it's a mislead, which is much like this movie. This movie is that whole media res is a giant mislead to what you're expecting, which is that, do you consider that to be a cheat?
Nope.
Because the movie, guess you're getting, okay, so you're both saying no, and I'm more proposing that as like on a devil's advocate kind of thing. Another great movie that probably has great font in the titles.
Yes.
But, closer to God.
But this movie opens with Denzel Washington, the actor, narrating a story in which he almost died. And so the entire movie you're thinking Denzel Washington's going to win, and by the end, spoilers, no, it's not actually Denzel Washington's character at that point. It's the Azazel demon in possession of Denzel Washington. So that's not, you don't consider that to be a cheat? Like, you're not being misled to believe a certain thing?
Well, it's part of the fun.
Yeah?
Yeah. And also the big clue right away is that he is more, you know, exuberant than any Denzel Washington voiceover you're going to, you know, you're likely to hear this, you know, especially in a movie like this. You know, I remember, you know, I first saw this film in theaters, and the first line is like, whoa, he's really energetic. Okay, fair enough. Going forward.
Yeah, and a lot of times where Scott and I are talking, like, tired of that narrative device is, like, a lot of films were in post-production crutch on it because there's no action within the first, like, 20 minutes, and they want
to... Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
It's the studio.
It's never intended to be that way, and it comes obvious, but...
No, you're absolutely right. This is one where it was, I presume, constructed that way from the beginning for a very specific purpose. It wasn't, like, as you said, just a hook.
And this is one of Elias Coty's, like, most effective roles, and he's barely in this movie.
Uh-huh.
Like, he'll return in, like, a video sequence later, but this is, I mean, like, it after this, and he's just powerful and, like, memorable, and he owned the trailer for this movie.
Yeah, and, you know, this is 8 years after Ninja Turtles, and it's at this point, and maybe he just got old enough to be sort of a vaguely distinguished character actor, but he starts working a lot after this.
Mm-hmm.
You start seeing him in a lot more stuff.
Well, because, yeah, this is a Hollywood movie where he's starring in, like, what is it, like, Exotica and Gattaca, like, a lot of, you know, like, smaller scale movies that, you know, require, like,
this
some kind
Gattaca.
Of...
Gattaca, I forgot about that.
Yeah, Gattaca, I like Gattaca.
Yeah, he's in Gattaca. But yeah, he's doing a lot more, you know, low key work, and he's good. He's friends with, like, Adam McGuire.
Yeah, he's in like the first
Exotica.
Prophecy movie, right?
The first Prophecy movie, yeah. It's like little random roles.
Crash.
This is, you know,
that was
was it Cronenberg movie, right? So it's like, you know, these are movies for, like, character actor type work, but, like, on a low key scale. This is a Denzel Washington Warner Brothers production. So, like, and yeah, he's after this, he's in what, Thin Red Line. Collateral Damage, I'm thinking about. he's in another, what's his name, from Gattaca, Andrew Niccol, Simone. He's in Simone. since then, he's become a very consistent, like, you know, character actor. Mm-hmm. Zodiac.
Yeah, he's terrific.
Just jumping up forward in time now. That's all, we talked all, like, that's 5 minutes in, now we're getting to the opening titles, by the way. We got, like, entire cold open, which is just Denzel and Codius. And now we get Time Is On Your Side playing for the first time, right? Oh, the credits get way spookier now, right? Because you have fading fog credits
notice, like,
coming in.
Azazel Vision is, like, the same as, like, getting high in Denzel's car in Training Day.
Yeah.
Smoke, PCP.
It's a Warner Brothers thing.
Yeah.
You get wet.
Or
I like Azazel Vision, though. Like, we talk about this with 90s movies, especially, Brandon, where it has that kind of, like, here's an,
like,
off-kilter angle to,
and,
like...
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. This is, like, and it's clever. I was reading the trivia on this. They shot it, like, it's a camera they use for, like, still photography, and there's, like, a lot of low cranking on it, and it's, like, it's running at a different frames per second.
It was basically a typical, like, grunge metal music video look that,
yes,
you know, when it went into movies, it just, like, stuck out. And,
like, Azazel Vision looks like the flashbacks,
right,
from The Crow,
yeah,
which we talked about in another commentary.
And, like,
the iTunes
Aliens
right now.
Vision and Alien 3 has it, and
Fincher's all
Star
about
Trek,
that
Star Trek First Contact used it too a bunch, which is the, like, the one thing that makes that movie feel like, oh, it's kind of old. But
so why can't as we know, the Azazel, when he touches people, he can transfer to other people. Why isn't he getting out of other people at this moment? Do we know? Or is he just, like, not wanting to right yet?
Maybe he's, like, conjuring up the spell or something? Like, he's, like, this guy, this sadistic guy,
he's about to
is,
do,
like
a whole era
on Azazel, I think. That's the thing. He's, like, bringing him out through this guy rather than, he's not Azazel right now, but I think through death.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah, some occult-type killer guy that's hoping to bring about...
What I like about this movie, not to get too far ahead of it, is it almost, in retrospect, reminds me of an M. Night Shyamalan picture, in that it takes a potentially trashy grindhouse premise and makes a very serious, grounded drama out of it.
Well,
now, this is not a film that has a lot of gratuitous violence. It doesn't have a lot of what you would consider action. And it basically is a drama that happens to be about, you know, a supernatural serial killer that jumps
the
mind
body.
Yeah,
it has suspenseful scenes that are just people touching people. Do you think?
Well, I think.
I was gonna say, do you think Sutherland was cast here for the Body Snatchers connection?
Probably. he seemed to have that going a lot in the 90s, between movies that are actually called Body Snatchers.
Puppet Masters.
Puppet Masters. Yeah, and movies like this. So yeah, he seemed to have a phase going on. I will say, I agree with you, Scott. That it works because it kind of. It grounds the supernatural, you know, element into making it into a kind of procedural drama. But I think I like this movie, but I think the weakest element might actually be its greatest asset, which is Denzel Washington. I think Denzel Washington, he's certainly serviceable because he's Denzel Washington. He's one of the greatest actors going. But I think there's the lack of defining him more as a character always kind of rubs me the wrong way. Like, it's a movie, you know, that's very much indebted to religion in one form or another because of the Azazel presence and just the people he seeks out to talk about Azazel. Yet, like, he has little things like he has no idea what the word apocalypse means. Like, he's like so like far disconnected from the idea of a supernatural entity or religion, even though he says, I believe his character goes to church a few times a day or like every so often. But he's like never heard of the word apocalypse before. It's the way he treats Azazel as if it's just another perp. That kind of, like, it's like, all right, like, everybody else seems to be, like, a more defined character, just fun, like, you know, John Goodman right here, or James Gandolfini, RIP, who are playing, like, they're playing, you know, they're characters. They, you know, they're supporting characters, so they get to have juicier roles or whatnot. They make Denzel into such a, whose name is, what, John Hobbs, which has its biblical connections right there. Like, they make him into such a straight arrow that I feel like if I could have registered maybe more if there was a little more, I don't know, divine connection that he had to what was going on.
I mean, there's a moment in this movie that's one of my, like, not just favorite, like, performed Denzel moments, but, like, maybe, like, acted of all time. And I'll point it out when we get to it in the movie. So I really do like his performance here in the movie, but he's giving the Denzel, I think Denzel has the ability to both be, like, a John Cusack type person where, you know, you put John Cusack to get John Cusack but he also has range where he could go beyond that typical character.
Yes.
But right here you get, you know, typical Denzel, which is better than 99% of the things you could get. So,
it's funny because you mentioned that in 98 where I talked about how there's three Denzel movies came out, The Siege, this movie, and He Got Game, and I'm aware, Brandon, you're not as big of a fan of He Got Game as I am. But you know, he gives a
right,
different
exactly,
kind of performance in that.
It's he can transform Denzel if he wants to, or he can give you typical Denzel, which is great too. So like,
yeah, and typical Denzel you see in both this movie and The Siege, where he plays like good, you know, good, well-meaning.
Right,
cop. Like that's essentially what he is. And this is like, you know, this is after Malcolm X in Philadelphia, and before, I don't know, Training Day. It's like, this is like Hollywood Denzel,
mm-hmm,
period.
This is where he's starting on his own in like mainstream pictures.
He's got like Crimson Tide's obviously a big one for him. You have Preacher's Wife, which gives him a little more family exposure because he smiles in that movie, which you don't see very often at all. and just, you know, other like, and, you know, Virtuosity, which we easily could have also done a commentary for. Yeah. Courage Under Fire, which is, you know, a little more prestige, but not, you know, it's not going for too much. Bone Collector, you know, there's a lot of these movies where it's like, it's just him, you know, confident
cop
type
character.
Right, and
that's, this one and Bone Collector were during that period where these were like, you know, I'm not going to throw them up there with like what, you know, today's superhero films, but like they were it was a popular genre after Silence of the Lambs, Seven, Copycat, you know, Fall and Kiss the Girls. Yeah, Bone Collector. Like, it was, it was that little like serial killer genre.
There's some kind of like a serial killer threat. Sometimes there's a supernatural force. Sometimes it's just straight
right,
up
yeah,
evil.
Yeah, yeah. So that was that was a popular genre in the 90s. Like a lot of the popular genres of the 90s was like, you know, aside from the pure action, which was like Top Dog, was, you know, just dramatic stuff. Which I
yeah, it's like legal yeah. thrillers and like intense cop
yes.
dramas.
Which now become
well, these were the eight pictures.
Yeah, which now
of
become
era.
Novelties yeah. when you see one. When you get something like the years ago, the Lincoln Lawyer was like, "Holy crap, we don't get this very often. We used to get this all the time."
Yeah.
Oh, but the funny thing is, you know, we like to think of something like this as the kind of movie they don't make that much anymore. But this was not a huge hit in 1998.
No, it's got like a 40% critical favoring on Rotten Tomatoes.
Oh,
yeah.
Which surprises me.
But I mean, I think it opened to about $10 million over, I want to say, Martin Luther King Day weekend.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
98.
Yep.
And we all thought, you know, the flood was getting, or hard rain, hard rain was going to be the biggie of that weekend.
Which is that's on our list,
oh, yeah.
by the way, movies to commentaries for. I like hard rain.
Slater, man. Yeah.
And this did okay. It's.
Well, this is
right.
This was during the Titanic
yeah.
slaughter.
Oh yeah, this was the Titanic massacre.
Yeah,
you know the
it's winning
unless you had Leo
City.
DiCaprio yeah. in your movie, you weren't competing with it at that time.
Pretty yeah. much, right up to the end.
Yeah, right up until Lost in Space.
Well, Matt
yeah.
LeBlanc came
you know,
and stole that spot.
U.S. Marshals was number one on Friday of its opening weekend. Grease re-release was number one on its opening weekend on Friday. But Titanic won the weekend, week after week after week after week after week. And there's a lot of good stuff that got whacked
oh, yeah.
in the process. You know, this, you know, Dark City, Primary Colors, Twilight, the Paul Newman, Susan Sarandon one.
Primary Colors did well, didn't it?
It did fine. But the only breakout hit of that era was The Wedding Crasher. I'm sorry, The Wedding Singer.
Wedding Singer, yeah.
That was a good... It's not like Titanic was such the obvious winner, but that was a good Oscar year too. I like the Best Picture nominees that year.
Oh, yeah, like Confidential,
yeah.
Goodwill Hunting, as good as it gets, which I haven't seen in years and probably hasn't aged well, but we'll see when I watch it again. Full Monty. Is Full Monty that year? Boogie Nights.
No,
it was
Full Monty. Full Monty was like the dark horse.
Yeah, that was
like
the fifth one.
People pulling footage.
Yeah.
Goodwill Hunting. Yeah, it was. I liked all those Best Pictures that year. I put it up there with, like, 1976 is, like, a really strong year of nominees.
We're talking all over
yeah.
this Denzel
with
backstory.
His brother
stuff.
And his,
everybody's
kid, his kid.
His brother who's mentally challenged in some way, not quite defined.
Yeah.
Like, but there's clearly he's not, you know, he's not all there.
And...
High function,
yeah. Yeah, he was married, now he lives here. See, like, he wears a cross around his neck. How does he not know what apocalypse means?
Well,
I'm surprised the line would be like, what's apocalypse? Is that the X-Men character?
Luckily for him, this summer he looked at the paper, saw that playing, and was like, oh, I don't know what that is, and skipped it.
Yeah.
I know to avoid that.
Yeah, so he lives with his brother, right? And the brother has a son.
Well, I think if anything, you know, and I don't even want to call it a weakness, but he plays such a regular character in this movie that you're right, he doesn't really have a ton of, you know, movie character quirks. He's just a guy who's a cop and he's slightly religious, but, you know, he's most of his time is spent either doing his job or looking after it. You know, his nephew and his brother, and that's basically his life.
I wonder if
there's
something cut about him, like, quitting smoking, because it's brought up very late in the movie, and, like, it was a thing, and it's... Maybe that was a quirk that they...
Yeah, I know, yeah, because I know it's like an offhand John
right,
Goodman
yeah.
line, right? He's like, I thought you quit smoking.
And
it's
like, huh?
Yeah, I don't... Who's this actor?
Yeah,
that's Robert Joy,
from,
right?
You know, he's doing a lot of things. I draw into Land of the Dead right now.
Land of the Dead is what I'm thinking of, clearly, yes. And he's also at the very end of Alien vs. Predator
right.
Requiem.
Right.
I'm looking at a director of this film, Gregory Hoblit's filmography, and he basically fits exactly, you know, 90s. Even though his movies extend past the 90s, everything he's done is pretty much like what was popular in the 90s. Primal Fear was obviously big for him. Then he did Fallen. Then he did Frequency,
yeah.
once again, supernatural cop drama. Hearts War is the only thing that kind of breaks out of there, but then you get back to Fracture. Anthony Hopkins, Ryan Gosling, legal drama, Untraceable, serial killer.
Which is awful.
Yeah, it's a terrible movie.
And it basically killed his career.
Apparently, because
he barely works.
He did an episode of The Americans.
Yeah, you know, I remember that. I remember seeing that in the thing. It's like, oh, that guy, because I love The Americans. So.
You know, I liked his films. I would look forward to his pictures. And I think to a certain extent, when you know, not to be simplistic, when Hollywood stopped making movies like this, the directors that made movies like that struggled.
Mm-hmm. We did an episode of The Strain as well. Okay, so we got that FX money.
You know, there's a reason Rennie Harlan has to go to China. The script trace is not very good.
Yeah, which is
why I'm not super duper thrilled for Shanghai Dawn. Because I think that moment is past, but whatever. I'll see it and hope for the best.
I'm not, because I'm not a fan of Jared Hess's movies.
Yeah.
So
that too?
That's not helping me out.
Scott, you're not excited about one of the top 10 greatest films of all time getting a follow-up?
I don't need a second one. It's perfect as it is.
It's the Dark Knight of the Shanghai Trilogy.
Yeah, absolutely.
The Dragon Rises.
All right, so we got John Goodman.
Okay, this one opened my eyes to John Goodman, the actor. I wasn't really familiar too much with his Coen Brothers work at the time. I don't think I had seen Bloodsucker Proxy, but the back catalog of them I wouldn't check out for another year or so.
He's in
but he was in Flintstones. And Roseanne and Matinee. And Matinee was good in that, but it was something that lent itself to him. But and then this one, I thought I really enjoyed, especially in the end. He goes all out.
Did you see
Babe? Yeah, there's Babe. King Ralph, was it? Yeah.
Yeah.
King Ralph.
No, he's excellent in the Babe.
Oh, you had Big Lebowski this year too.
It was weeks later.
So another casualty.
You really see the range of, Big Lebowski was never going to make money regardless. But
that's true.
Well, I don't know. Coming off of Fargo, I guess there probably could have been some potential there.
No, because he didn't do that much worse than Fargo.
Yeah. No, Fargo did well.
Yeah, I did $25 million, which was fine back then. And then Lebowski,
I
think I'm going off memory.
That's
17.
Right. Yeah.
Arachnophobia.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. No, I've always been a big fan of Goodman, but this one really turned me on to his dramatic chops, I think.
Well, he has Goodman he's the kind of guy where he's big, obviously, and he can play it broad, but he also has a kind of a, which I think is what works in Flintstones. He has a face where you're there's an innocence in it. And it comes out here as the partner where it's he wants to believe in Denzel the whole time. And you kind of see a sweetness there, even if he can be kind of a tough guy, which obviously you see.
Sopranos prequel going on right now.
Yeah, right now, with Tony and Totoro's sister. With that mustache, too, James Gandolfini.
Oh, but Goodman...
This one, Gandolfini was
straight
up. Oh, yeah,
he was always a sleazeball and everything. He had, 8mm.
Yes, 8mm. Fits right in the 90s, right? That's a 90s movie right there, 8mm.
Yeah. Dude...
Hey, the first hour of that movie,
it's
very good.
And then there's a second hour.
I revisited it a couple years ago, and it's almost hilarious where we've come with, pornography and stuff to what it was back then. How was this dark and evil?
Well, and it's... Okay. Well, I've always found Joel Schumacher to be a really weirdly Puritan filmmaker. Even something for me, it sort of climaxed with Phone Booth, where you deserve to die for having impure thoughts. You know, you wanted to have sex with Kenny Ohms, even though you didn't.
I was on board for 8mm. I was a fan of Andrew Kevin Walker from Writing Seven and stuff.
Yeah.
And I was really excited for 8mm, and I liked it. I was okay with it back then, but I mean, revisiting it was it was kind of funny. But I still think Joaquin Phoenix was quite good in that movie.
Oh, I think everyone is very good. Just the second half for me gets a little overboard on the whole, pornography equals
right,
the devil.
Right, yeah, that's
kind
why.
Of
I mean, it's comical where they go with it.
Yeah, but I will say, the scene where he calls up the victim's mother to ask for permission to kill him is something you've never seen in any other movie. It's like, oh, that's amazing. That's okay. I'll go with that.
This seems like
I've never seen that in a movie before.
This seems the most clean cut I've ever seen Donald Sutherland, by the way.
He
seems so he's like...
He's clean shaven.
He's clean shaven. His hair's, nice.
He's unrecognizable.
He's not...
He's got the like the Arlie Ermey like 7 haircut. Frumpy,
yeah, compared to like big frumpy mustache and shaggy hair, like it's like, all right, like I
like that. James Gandolfini's skinnier than I remember, and he put on weight for The Sopranos. He doesn't look that big here.
He isn't, and like same with like True Romance and like early. Yeah.
He was
Crimson
just a stocky
Tide.
guy back in the day.
He was stocky. I don't think he, I don't know if he necessarily put on weight for The Sopranos, but like he certainly he was you know more heavy set. But then like was it The Mexican? He had to lose weight for that movie.
Yeah,
and then he had to put it back on again after to get back into The Sopranos. Which was because he established the, you know, the TV identity on Sopranos, but then he's like, I'm going to go do this Brad Pitt movie, and he has to, like, lose weight. And then, I believe, what was it? What's his name? Is it David Chase?
Yeah, yep.
Yeah.
Sopranos, he's like, you were looking too skinny. We need you to get back that weight back on, which probably is not that great for, you know, James Gandolfini, and obviously, you know, he's not alive anymore, yeah. Which is sad. Where's Andrew Kevin Walker?
Oh, ghostwriting on stuff.
He's a ghostwriter guy. So.
There's a lot of stuff he's touched that. Because we did a commentary. He worked on Sleepy Hollow. That was like one of his last big scripts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He has like a hand in Wolfman.
Yeah,
apparently.
Yeah.
But that's.
But he still does stuff. I mean, he cleans up Fincher's scripts still. He just doesn't get credit on them.
Oh, yeah, because they're friends.
Right.
That's why,
yeah,
like,
no,
they're
he's got
buddies.
Something called Nerdland. That came out this year that it's got Patton Oswalt and Paul Rudd. Oh, cartoon, right? Yeah.
That's going to be at Beyond Fest this year in Los Angeles. I just saw that on the schedule, actually. Let's see. Who wrote this movie? Nicholas Kazan, who gave us other hits such as Matilda and Bicentennial Man.
Yeah.
All M. Beth Davids movies.
Oh, wow, yeah.
We're
not to her yet. But she's...
Yeah, we'll get to her. We'll wait. We have 2 hours to kill. We'll get there. These various
homegrown.
Characters.
Homegrown. Remember Homegrown? Oh, I don't either. I was thinking Home Fries. My bad.
Yeah, Home Fries. That's a Vince Gilligan
right.
From Breaking Bad. He did
No, Homegrown's a Billy Bob Thornton movie with John Lithgow.
That's like right next to Sling
John
Blade, then.
John Lithgow, Ryan Phillippe, Hank Azaria.
What is this movie, Homegrown?
Funny enough, it's our next commentary. Awesome. No.
Yeah, I know, right?
From 98. It was also 98. This dude was killing it then.
Directed by directed by Gyllenhaal?
Steven Gyllenhaal? John Bon Jovi? Kelly Lynch? Judge Reinhold? Jamie Lee Curtis?
What is Homegrown, and where do we find this? It's not available on Amazon, apparently. Anyway, back
to the following
this
commentary is one big commercial for 1998's Homegrown.
Homegrown, coming soon to Amazon Prime after many emails. Okay, we can get back. Now things are happening. So now Hobbs is like, person got murdered, looks very similar to Elias Codius's serial killings. And so now it's like, why does that happen?
He's got an accomplice.
And now our copycat. Another 1995's copycat.
Harry Connick Jr., Sigourney
Holly Hunter.
Holly Hunter? Sigourney Weaver. That's what I'm thinking.
Sigourney Weaver, Holly Hunter.
Dermot Mulroney.
No,
sorry.
Dermot Mulroney.
Not Dylan McDermott.
Dylan McDermott Mulroney.
Yes.
Dylan McDermott Mulroney.
Which is a mostly wonderful
Copycat?
Movie.
Oh, yeah.
Copycat?
Yeah.
It has that shocking turn in it, too, that I didn't see coming.
But the end is a little generic.
What was the thriller like? Was it Just Cause with Connery and Fishburne?
One's pretty awful. I
saw it one time.
You know who the daughter in that is, right?
I'm not.
Scarlett Johansson.
Mm-hmm. Ghost World. Scarlett.
Johansson. One of her first roles as. Bound and Gag Daughter.
Was she Bound and Gag Daughter in Horse Whisperer too?
No.
Here we go. Army of Darkness.
I don't remember. Man, is she the daughter is she the kid that is injured? Or is she the one that dies in the Horse Whisperer?
I think injured.
Okay, I saw it once in 1998.
Yeah, they tend to like crediting her with that as her first movie, but it's not true. There's a couple of those. Just Cause. Just Cause is another classic 90s, not classic, but it's, you know, another straight up 90s movie.
Okay, I don't know what we were talking about. What were we talking about?
Hey, look, it's M. Beth Davids.
There she is, straight out of Army of Darkness and Schindler's List and into a supernatural thriller with Denzel Washington.
Who nobody refers to as Spider-Man's mom.
Yep, but she's Matilda's teacher.
She is, and she's doing she has a really good turn going on Ray Donovan right now. Been enjoying her on that.
Who does she play? Is she the wife of?
I think she's the daughter of the cop that died in 1965.
Okay.
Right.
There we go. She has the same basic look as Matilda. Well, anyway. Gotta find things to say about this Denzel Washington performance right now, because all he's just like standing doing his Denzel thing. He's like, yeah, all right, okay. Probing questions, confidence. Yeah, so yeah, he's talking straight up about the detective thing.
Well, if I say yes, do I get a cup of coffee?
Looks like I do.
But yeah, a lot of this movie's taking place in this like rooms and chatting.
Yeah, because it's.
It's, I mean, keeps know, a it's a low super, budget. And...
It's a supernatural thriller, but like there aren't many like thrills in it. Like there's one jump scare, maybe.
Yeah, it's low on the jump scares, and I think one was added. I read that like one was added to the end of the movie because of something that happened during like a
test screening.
A test screening, yeah. So
yeah, I mean, it's very procedural, like, and it
right, yeah, yeah.
And it,
that's
I mean,
what a lot of these movies were.
Yeah, the get,
well,
the, yeah.
I would say even in, you know, I remember in 98, this was a very low-key picture. It struck me as, you know, again, the guy kills people by injecting them with syringes, for God's sakes. That's not exactly the flashiest, most grotesque way of killing somebody.
Well, the movie certainly starts out presenting itself as such, where you have this elaborate opening sequence with Time Is On Your Side playing and Elias Cody is giving it his all. It, which actually reminds me a lot of something like, I don't know, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, the Fincher version, where you have this almost like a Bond opening with Karen O screaming the Immigrant Song.
Yeah.
And it's like, the movie's nothing like that. And it's like, where's this coming from?
We're going to go hang out in the secluded, snowy estate.
Yeah. Followed by, you know, after this elaborate Bond opening with like all kinds of imagery and whatnot, it's like, all right.
Starring this person, this person, this person, this person, and Stellan Skarsgård
as probably the villain. Yeah, this movie, I mean, you know, it opens with, you know, Elias Cody is just dancing up and down the aisle to Death Row and the song playing and the spooky credits that we were talking about. And now we're just, you know, straight up Denzel doing his cop thing.
Yeah.
Do you think he took this movie after Seven happened and became a hit? Because, you know, he was supposed to play that role, or it was at least offered to him, wasn't it?
Oh, it was?
For Mills, for the Brad Pitt character, he was going to play, okay. Like, it was going to be a reuniting of Freeman and Denzel after Glory, where he could have, you know, played the younger cop to Morgan Freeman's veteran officer, or detective, but I believe...
Imagine Denzel doing the What's in the Box?
What's in the box? What's in there?
In the box?
I want to know what's in that box.
What's wrapped up in those funny papers?
Plausible.
Yeah, it'd be plausible, but you know, it'd be feel a little more cold because you'd have like half a shoulder turned towards the box. Like, what's in that box over there? You know, I want to know. I guarantee it's not what I think it is.
Why don't you look in the box and tell me what's in the box?
I do like the idea that this is a movie that centers around a demon getting pissed off at Denzel Washington and wanting to make his life a living hell.
Right.
It's almost as goofy as like Drag Me to Hell, as far as like a demon gets denied a bank loan and so she tortures the person because of it. That's what this movie essentially is. He got seemingly like the ego got bruised because Denzel Washington caught the serial killer, so it's like, I'm gonna make Denzel Washington's life terrible.
will pay. You know, I like when this guy loses his power and he goes home and he finds out all the horrible stuff he's done. Or not horrible stuff, but his job.
Uh-huh.
And stuff. I kind of like this. He was like, oh my gosh.
Yeah, give you an idea of the repercussions of being possessed by a demon. Is it a demon or was it like a spirit?
Azazel.
Azazel.
Demon angel.
It's a fallen angel. The movie's called Fallen, so it's a fallen angel. I think that's the way to go.
It's one of those Azazel movies. They only make them every couple of years. I don't know.
It gets remade just as much as Body Snatchers.
I think that the quirk with Denzel is his brother and his nephew living with him. That's probably the thing we have that it makes you take and make you going the whole movie going, what is wrong with his brother? Is he slow? Is he what?
Well, I think it's clear that he has, you know, whatever is going on, it's a relatively high functioning issue, but you know, what after he got divorced, it was just easier for everybody if they all just lived together.
Right.
It makes you like Brandon, you mentioned, if you know the smoking thing is plays a bigger plot or you know part of the plot in like an earlier version of the film or whatnot. It makes like I wonder how much input Washington has at this point in films, or if the script is always just like there's no like. You know, M. Beth Davis is here, but she's not like a romantic lead of any kind. And Denzel doesn't have really any attachments of that manner, which is pretty typical for a lot of Denzel movies at this time, because he kind of shied away from having romantic partners in his films for a time. Or at least something that's not already established. Like, he could be married or something, like he's in Philadelphia, but like he's not like, you know, Pelican Brief is famous for him not embracing that idea of having, you know, getting into a relationship.
Part of that is he tended to get paired with white actresses, and he often wasn't terribly comfortable, you know,
being a part of a mixed relationship,
interracial relationship,
in a big Hollywood movie.
Yeah, and certainly audiences on both sides of the proverbial fence were never particularly thrilled with that. I remember when He Got Game came out, there were some Denzel fans that were pissed that he had sex with Mila Jovovich. Black fans, I should reiterate.
A fan base that he's established. Yeah.
Yes. Now, in Pelican Brief, I think, frankly, it made for a better movie because, you know, her fiance just got blown up.
Yeah.
So it does not make sense that she's going to shag the first guy she runs into again.
No, it moves away from the cliche, which I think is kind of parodied in, The Player, right? With Bruce Willis at the end rescuing Julia Roberts, his character from Death Row. It was like, traffic was a bitch, right? He says the line. I just watched The Player on Criterion, really. That movie's still fantastic. No needles in that death scene, by the way. This guy just stabbed the hell out of the other guy.
Yeah.
But still no blood.
And it was a 90s vision, so we couldn't quite see the blood. That's fake rain. That can't be real. That does not look like
rain. One of the things I like about this movie is that the very act of violence is horrific enough. It doesn't have to be shown in grotesque detail. The very act of taking a life is in itself terrible and horrifying. And obviously there's a scene in about an hour where he's forced to kill an innocent person, and it's to a certain extent, it's almost the film's emotional climax.
Oh, it is. It's exactly the film's emotional climax. That's what it's trying to go for. But, you look at some movies were more happy to embrace the kind of grislier sides of things, while others didn't. Seven, for all the terrible things that happen, it's more implied than anything. Like, that's...
Yeah, most of the violence is off-screen in Seven.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. There's just enough to make you think you're seeing, the only on-screen violence is when he kills John Doe at the end.
You see the aftermath.
It's the context that makes it, nauseating, because there's some, horrible things happen in that movie, no doubt, but like, you're not seeing them take place. And, the movie, it has plenty of other things going for it that also make it into kind of a modern classic of crime thrillers, per se, but like, yeah, this movie, you know, which is by no means a mod, despite the three of us liking it and being the, you know, the few to want to embrace the movie for what it's doing right. It, you know, it's also not a, it's not a, it's not a classic by any means, but it's certainly, it's competent in what it's doing, and it has a deliberate choice and style of how it approaches the horrific things that take place.
Well, it's interesting to me when I watch, for example, Silence of the Lambs, and you have to imagine people when they were making, for example, Just Cause or Taking Lives or what have you, they thought they were possibly at least trying to make something on the level of Silence of the Lambs. But that film really is on another level of its the films that followed in its wake. It's not just a serial killer procedural.
Mm-hmm. Well, the only one to like stand out was like Seven. That was like,
which was different enough from Silence of the Lambs to stand on its own 2 feet. First of all,
because it had a visionary director attached to it. I don't think any of the other ones had anyone that.
And it had a very clearly established, like, you know, not gimmick, but like a premise of like there's a serial killer killing based off Seven Deadly Sins, and you have a very distinct look, and you have Brad Pitt, who's in the middle of, like, he's, you know, Hollywood's pretty boy and veteran. Like, it's, Morgan Freeman's, like, always been a veteran actor. Veteran actor Morgan Freeman, you know, lending his kind of...
The Electric Company.
Yeah, yes.
Listerine's Morgan Freeman.
But yeah, I'm trying to think of ones that kind of really stand out as far as, you know, between, aside from Silence of the Lambs and Seven, and I can't think of any that aren't, you know, movies I might just kind of like... or find to be better, you know, underrated to an extent, or just, you know, whatever.
They're all just, I mean, they're like fine. Yeah. Is what they probably at best what you'd say. It's like, oh, it was fine. It's a good watch, but I mean, there's nothing you
like
you take from it other than, like, you know, having a nice like bag of like Lay's or something like that.
You know, and I enjoy the Alex Cross movies, but those films are fine.
Kiss the Girls is fine.
I like Lock Him Spider.
It has
deliciously.
It has the, well, you go with Michael Wincott, so I mean, it has that going for it.
It has that, but then you have to sit through Monica Potter for the whole thing too. And...
So we can go to Metro with Eddie Murphy and Michael Wincott and Michael Rapaport.
It's going to be weird because its legacy is not that, but the next thing to jump and stick would be Saw.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, because I think these movies, Saw, Seven, and Silence of the Lambs, S trilogy, they're all essentially procedural thrillers, but they have an extra element that pushes them into, you know, near horror, essentially. Yeah. Saw is obviously the most overtly on the side of horror just because of the nature of the serial killer and the way it's being directed and just the, you know, the score, the way the movie's structured, it moves like a horror film. Seven and Silence of the Lambs, you know, they're more debatable as far as what they're, you know, ultimately doing.
Well, Seven took notes from Silence and then Saw took Seven, notes from
yes,
Seven.
Exactly. So, but like each of those notes meant emphasize the horror more. Like that seems to be what the takeaway is.
Yeah.
Like go darker. I don't know if Saw is more nihilistic. I think Saw is more nihilistic than Seven. It's just more, I don't know. It's zippier than Seven is. Like, to it, for whatever that means. Because it's, what's Saw, like 90-something minutes maybe?
Yeah, it's really quick.
It's about 105. Okay. It's actually longer than the sequels.
Oh, okay.
1 and 3 are relatively
all
long.
All that Zep stuff. all that Michael Emerson stuff in there.
Zep, who never came back for a flashback.
Oh.
Well, he had that lost money, so he didn't need to do anything.
That's true.
It's funny. I have my issues with Saw. It's no secret that I like some of the sequels better, but part of the problem is just, you know, through no fault of the filmmakers, I knew who Michael Emerson was. So as soon as he showed up, I knew he was one of the killers. I had seen him on The Practice, where he played a serial killer who cut off people's heads.
I don't remember being the, like, one that... supposed to be a surprise.
Kill anybody though. That was a
He just took actions that made no sense, like randomly threatening. Wait, is it Monica Potter in that movie?
Don't believe Adam's lies.
Yeah, he's supposed to be like reluctantly. But anyway, I don't want to get into why I don't like Saw.
He's randomly threatening her character, even though he's like not actually
like rubbing a gun on their faces.
It's a
very
weird
child. So, yeah.
Anyway, Denzel Washington's playing basketball with his nephew or whatever right now. So.
This is the first time we've seen John Goodman outside, right?
Yeah, he's
right?
been on the desk the whole time, and generally when it's raining.
Desk and then that bar.
The bar. Now the streets are completely dry, by the way, even though it's been raining a lot tonight. Then, by the way, the city, it's unnamed, even though it's Philadelphia. But it, you know, it follows that seven pattern of like just random metropolitan area. I'm not sure if that was like a theme of just like look how dark things get for these places.
Well, you don't have to play by rules. You can turn on this street and be all the way across town for your next shoot.
I guess
without any
for the people that live in these towns that are like, wait a minute, no, hold on here.
I think in a skewed way, having an undisclosed locale potentially adds a certain timelessness to the film.
I mean, that's one thing I like. I'm oddly throw it to like DC Comics. I enjoy the made up cities that they can just do whatever with.
Yeah.
As opposed to holding to real world.
That comes
things
and goes,
like,
though. If Spider-Man didn't have New York, I wouldn't get all of those favorite scenes in those movies of Spider-Man doing something with much of the population that celebrates why they're New Yorkers.
Oh, well, yeah. Give it take.
I'm kidding about that. But I do like the... I like both, essentially. I like the, you know, DCS Metropolis and wherever the hell Arrow lives and the Flash live, which all apparently seem to be around each other and are that big, yet are somehow far enough that they can't help each other out all the time.
If you don't want to get murdered, move elsewhere.
I knew very little about the maps of these worlds, and after I was like, okay, I have Gotham Metropolis. Where the hell are it's like was it Central City or Starlight City? Like, where are these places?
Central City, I think it's the Flash.
Yeah, Central City is the Flash.
Starling City is
like,
Arrow.
Coast City, that's
I know,
Green
Lantern.
That's
supposed to be, you know, like a West Coast city, but what are the other ones supposed to be? Like, where are those?
Metropolis?
Gotham's New York.
Gotham's like Jersey, essentially, right? What's Starlight City and Central City? Where are those supposed to be? Like, are they all on the East Coast?
Cleveland.
New England. That's one. It's a busy New England.
Well, if you go by Smallville rules, wasn't Metropolis in Kansas?
Oh. I always figured Metropolis is supposed to be New York. It's got an ocean right next to it. Anyway, here's the scene where Denzel Washington does Evil Dead and explores a mysterious cabin in the woods. He's looking around. There's probably like a possessed clock and a bench on some chains out the side. And we're getting narration, right? We're getting narration, which is Azazel's narration. Which makes me wonder, who is he telling this story to? Is it Jimmy Olsen?
Right. Do you guys remember another film of this ilk, The Pledge, starring Jack Nicholson and his mustache?
Yes! I remember seeing the poster a lot.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And Benicio del Toro's in that one, too, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And Patricia Clarkson.
Yeah,
not to arbitrarily pick sides, but that's the one he should have gotten nominated for, and as opposed to About Schmidt.
What was I just thinking? Bloodwork. That's another like it's 2002.
Oh, yeah,
it's another like cop, you know, Clint Eastwood cop thriller.
Hold on a minute. What's Jeff Daniels doing with that earring and those hat and big sunglasses? Oh, we weren't supposed to recognize him?
See, it feels...
That was... Because I really liked... Eastwood did, what, True Crime before that.
I liked that one.
And then,
yeah.
And then he did Blood Work. And I was just like, wow.
Mystic River was kind of a comeback.
Oh, it was, for sure. As far as, like, you know...
Right, yeah. Well, like, Blood Work had, like... The setting for something I would like, it just was not executed. Or maybe just the source novel wasn't too good. But I was like, oh, I like this type of movie.
Yeah,
when they don't give it away right away.
Yeah.
And it was like, yeah, blah, blah, blah. And Jeff Daniels as...
There's the jump scare right there where the rafter moves. That's the reason part. Because, like, nothing's happened. Like, and it's weird that they wouldn't think to do that ahead of time. Because, like, Denzel Washington explores a house for, like, 15 minutes. It's like...
A house full of cobwebs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And... a spooky house in the woods where no one else's is. Like, he's like, something should be happening here. But he's Denzel, so he's hardly even... He's hardly moved by this. He's just like, oh, that happened. He doesn't get scared. He's Denzel Washington.
Yeah, Denzel doesn't jump at a scare. Jump
like that. Is this, like, the closest he's gotten to horror? Am I missing anything?
This bone collector.
heart condition? I don't know.
No, yeah, this might be as good. Yeah.
Well, that's more sci-fi, but Book of Eli is, like, sci-fi. Like,
right, no, yeah, yeah. No, there's horror. Nothing horror about Book of Eli. Yeah, that's...
Well, you know, for a while, you know, I think for a while, you know, this was sort of the start of that, start-ish, I mean, where he just started being, you know, an action hero to a certain extent. You know, the Avenger with a gun, the righteous, you know, obviously Man on Fire's, you know, was taken before that
was
taken.
Well, that's like a different era. Like you're saying, though, yeah, because, like, Crimson Tide, Virtuosity, Devil in a Blue Dress to an extent, that's a great movie, though, Courage Under Fire, it's less procedural, it's more, it's, you know, Edswick, Fallen, The Siege, Bone Collector, like, all of those, yeah, that's pretty much him in, like, an action hero mode. You know, there's some in between there, like Preacher's Wife, and He Got Game, in this kind of 90s zone, that kind of player, in Hurricane, obviously, these play around with other ideas and prestige stuff, but, yeah, he's...
And Wholesome, Remember the Titans was a big... But he follows that up with Training Day.
That's
sort of family wholesome to.
And Training Day marks a new direction for his career. Like, he still does a couple, like, random ones, like Out of Time and John Q, which, you know, are.
Out of Time is a nice little noir movie.
That was like a rare flop for him. It was a really fun movie.
I like it too. But, like, I thought
Dean Cain was going to come back after that movie.
Not enough. Yeah.
He kept trying to make Carl Franklin a thing. Yeah. God bless him.
Well, because, God, Devil in a Blue Dress is so good. It's like, why? That could have been his whole series of movies. Like that could have been his Mission Impossible. Like, every few years, Denzel Washington comes out and plays Easy Rollins again. I love that. That'd be great.
The irony is, if he did it now, it probably would be.
Yeah.
He could do it now. There's plenty of books. Denzel looks like Denzel. But, yeah, like, after Training Day, and, you know, give or take a few things, it's more like,
He becomes
not quite Morgan Freeman, but more of that, like, veteran type character that's, you know, ahead of the game, like, but, like, you know, kind of old man action type stuff, Man on Fire, Deja Vu.
Well, if you do a Denzel, if he's in a movie, it's a Denzel movie. I think we've talked about this before, where it's like his co-stars in his movies are at best like mid-level big character names rather than like him doing Two Guns with Mark Wahlberg. It's like, whoa.
Yeah.
You brought something, but he leads his movies. Like, they're, you know, there's no question about it.
The thing where he brings on a young white male would be movie star and they can score a hit and they can pretend that the other guy kind of deserves some of the credit.
Safe House.
Yeah. Unstoppable. That's a terrific picture.
I'm sad Tony Scott died, but, you know, he certainly went out on a good note.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, that or Enemy of the State are my favorite Tony Scott films.
Enemy of the State is probably my favorite, like, mainstream Tony Scott movie.
Yeah.
Like as far as, like, Tony Scott, and, like, his, like, later career, like, Tony Scott going full Tony Scott type of thing. Because I love True Romance, but,
Yeah.
But, like, him going all crazy with the cameras and what, like, because I also like Domino, but, like, I'm not gonna pretend. Oh, yeah.
I like Domino.
The sad thing about Tony Scott dying is that it won't complete. He can't complete the Train trilogy with Denzel between Taking a Pelham 1-2-3 and Unstoppable. Like, I was hoping like he and Dakota Fanning would reunite for a third Train movie.
What's
that movie on the TV?
It's interesting for a guy that almost never does sequels and if he actually makes the Equalizer, that'll be his first. He makes a lot of remakes.
Yeah.
And I think part of that is that, you know, I write about this at one point, but it's sort of a symptom of, you know, quote unquote, the kind of movies they don't make anymore. Well, if you want Denzel Washington material, you go back to when movies like that were more common. And you find the source
pretty
material.
Rangy too, as far as if they're good or not, because yeah. Like, The Preacher's Wife's not bad. What else is here? Manchurian Candidate, that's not bad. Yeah, like, it's not great.
Yeah, don't tell anyone. I like Manchurian Candidate as much as the original.
Yeah, I'm not gonna go that. I like Liev Schreiber in that actually quite a bit. I think he's really good in that movie.
Yeah. Oh yeah, he's terrific.
Liev Schreiber's always most of the time terrific.
Let's see, what else? Taking a Pelham I didn't like.
No, I didn't care.
And the original's really—it doesn't hurt that the original's really good. So I was like, "Oh man, okay."
Yeah, I like the TV movie with Vincent D'Onofrio.
There's a TV version of Vince Taking a Pelham 1-2-3.
There is 98-ish. Ooh. 98 again.
James Olmos is in it. He's the Walter Matthau, and D'Onofrio's the Robert Shaw, and Richard Schiff's in it. And Donnie Wahlberg, they're all the criminal. This sounds amazing.
Wow.
who directed this? Oh, it's a TV movie. It doesn't matter. Okay.
Yeah, just looking at his, like, filmography up and down, it's just nothing's the same after one another. It's always, I mean, he always goes on a stretch of rangy different roles and types of movies before going back to something similar.
He tends to have some great names. Jake Shuttlesworth, Lincoln Rhyme, Nathaniel Serling, E.G. Rollins, Whip Whitaker is easily the best one. Whip Whitaker,
yes.
Keith Frazier. Bobby Trench. These are some names.
Alonzo
Tobin
Harris.
Frost from Safe House, which is like a Bond villain, essentially.
But Lincoln Rhyme? Did you say that one? Yeah, that's...
Nick Stiles. That's Ricochet. Napoleon Stone? That's Heart Condition, which... Xavier Quinn in The Mighty Quinn.
John Quincy Archibald.
Let's see. Trip. That's glory. Trip. So now we're not talking too much about Fall because like the movie, it's a very big mood piece. Like there's a lot of like stocking of things and you know it's a lot of visual storytelling essentially. So it's like
it's a slow burn movie.
You know, it proceeds at its own pace and it has a lot of like we're learning that this demon really hates Denzel Washington. And so, he's just kind of stalking him from a distance and doing stuff to him, messing with him. But it is neat to see, because Denzel, like, he's not off his game at all, but, like, he's not worried, but he's concerned. He's just like, huh, what's that going on over there? Like, but he's not freaked out by anything, because he's Denzel Washington. And now he's having his, like, Brad Pitt in Seven moment where he learns about, you know, things that happen in the Bible. That's what he's going through right now. And mixing that with detective work. Oh, now it's got the cat. Is this narration again, too, that's happening? Because, like, it's...
Here's a foreshadow to the kitty.
Because you know the narration is supposed.
Who's also
it's trying to convince us that you know it's Denzel narrating the story, and so that's you have to walk a pretty like tricky line to be able to make it appear as if it's another character, but make it work for both characters at the same time.
Yeah, and it's tricking us by being this generic blah blah blah, what's on his mind type stuff, where it's like, yeah, this is not helping the movie. It's weird, but it's messing with us and we don't know it.
There's actually a fan cut of this movie that deletes the opening narration and removes the ending, so it's Azazel doesn't win. They call it the Azazel cut, apparently.
That's stupid. Why would you take the time to
do
that?
Like, I can see because I know like Dark City has like used to had a fan cut before the director's cut came out that you know admitted the narration so it wouldn't like ruin obvious things that were not the non-obvious things are happening for the sake of the audience, because audience people are stupid apparently according to New Line. But you know, then the director's cut went along and fixed that. But this is, and you know, this isn't Blade Runner either, where the movie doesn't require narration, but you know, we're getting cold feet about whether or not it really should have it. This is a movie that relies on that narration. But we get a lot of fun stuff here with like the touching of people to move around Azazel, so you get them really close. And so now James Gandolfini has it, right? Mm-hmm. But yeah, you're right. He's not very heavy. He's stocky, like you said, Brandon. But he's certainly not as big as he got for.
Because he played a lot of like goons for like mob gang stuff like that, like kind of like the heavy guy, but not someone you're like too threatened by. It's kind of what he fall into, like what he is in like True Romance.
I guess he just beats up Patricia Arquette, but still, like he seems like a formidable threat. But yeah. he's more of a sleaze than anything. Like you wouldn't want to talk to this guy.
He's that guy who might come into the room like wiping coke off his nose before he's trying to.
Or he's that lovable bodyguard to get Shorty Bear. The stunt man. Yes. There's a great scene in that one where like where John Travolta confronts him on the stairs and he just like throws him down the stairs. Like he doesn't even like bat an eye at it. Get Shorty was based off a novel by L. Moore Leonard, who also wrote the book that inspired Out of Sight, a terrific Steven Soderbergh film. Oh, so now once again we're playing with the jumping around on bodies thing, and Denzel's like, I don't know what's happening, but everyone's singing this song around me. How would you handle something like this in real life? Like if you're, because it's like the movie's clearly grounded in a certain way, so it's like what's going on, but it's presenting this like impossible thing for like for a detective to try and comprehend,
prove, or
he clearly sees something that's happening, but he has no idea what to do with it.
This older woman always creeped me out. Hat. Like just her stare. It's her stare. Just feels otherworldly when she turns around. It's like, and the be hat. Awesome. Yeah, and the hat.
There's nothing really to add here. That's why we took a long pause. But yes, this was a creepy old woman staring down Denzel Washington, a man who's hard to stare down.
I think it's because she's very pale. And so, yeah, her like very blue eyes really kind of stand out as she's staring down Denzel Washington. What are these people thinking as they goes back and forth between bodies here?
There's just a gas leak in the city.
This is in the trailer, too. There's a lot of this outdoor stuff, I think. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. If you were to live life inside of a Surge bottle...
I'd like to think that Denzel stood in a room with a bunch of like random extras and is like, who can stare me down the best? And that's who they cast for this scene.
Hmm.
Who can give Denzel the stare down? That's certainly a formidable threat, though, when you look at it, too. It's like, this thing can be anywhere, and it's choosing not to like directly harm Denzel. So it's like, man, my life, I got to deal with a whole different kind of case here.
This would probably be a good time for me to mention the podcast Denzel Washington is the Greatest Actor of All Time, period, featuring W. Kamau Bell and Kevin Avery. If you like our show, that's another fun show, which talks about lots of things that are humorous, as well as worthy of movie trivia and what have you.
There's a part where he makes a really funny joke on the phone here. Is this the scene?
Yeah, because he's going to try to... It is
him and Goodman,
because he has to talk to Gandolfini in some way about he has to try to figure things out.
Yeah.
What's he wearing, by the way? Is that a vest? One of those because he has like a baggy shirt underneath it.
Denzel Washington has had many iconic looks in various films, but nothing may be greater than his zoot suits as seen in Malcolm X.
Oh, yeah, because James Gandolfini does not like the 60s, so there's no way he'd be singing a song from that era.
Not what he's a disco guy.
Yeah. All disco.
all disco all the time. That was Gandolfini's motto.
Big ABBA fan. Yeah, it's all the record.
He auditioned for Mamma Mia. He was going to be the Pierce Brosnan role.
My.
But the only reason, obviously, was that he didn't look enough like Amanda Seyfried. Here we go. This is classic Denzel right here. Pacing, giving a lecture about why he can't believe something, but he has to.
Denzel Washington loves to give guarantees in movies. Just watch them and find out how many times he has that word.
I always like to think Denzel blocks these scenes himself.
Right. The scene where you meet the only other person that believes you in a interesting, secluded place while having a loud conversation so people walking by can hear you.
Denzel Washington is an accomplished stage actor, and you can see another film from him based off a play by August Wilson called Fences this December.
He has nothing but brown in his wardrobe, apparently, because he's got this brown vest on. Now he's like a brown jacket, brown, like, bigger, little puffier vest underneath the jacket. It's a very autumn movie. So.
Yeah. That's true. So you still got that vest on?
Well, because now he has, like, it looks like he has, like, a puffier vest jacket over the vest. We're trying to decipher the costume design of Denzel Washington this movie right now. Yeah. That's the key right here.
And he's got the vest that, you know, maybe he could have, like, zip-on sleeves.
That was popular in the 90s, zip-on sleeves on vests.
Yeah. Yep. He's just pacing circles around M. Beth Davis.
That's why I think he did his own blocking. Like, he's like, I have a big monologue to deliver, a big discussion scene of things going on.
We're about to get to her little chase sequence. It's after they get done talking, isn't it?
Yeah. Just to give these characters something. Why does the movie need to be 2 hours? Well, I kind of wonder. It's like.
I don't think there's really anything like deep in this movie. It's a lot of erroneous detail.
Well, because eventually there's more and more like of him like processing the whole biblical aspect of this thing and discussing things with the nun where he, you know, discovers the word apocalypse. But
tell me more about this. Apocalypse.
But it plays a lot like just basically spiritual possession movies where some kind of spirit just like messes around with a character for a couple hours and then finds like fuck it and then just goes after him directly. Which is, you know, every Paranormal Activity movie. It's like we'll mess around for a few nights and then we'll just, you know, have a big giant climax at the end for some reason because I've got tired of it. And imagine Denzel Washington dealing with Paranormal Activity. Just him in a house. Just trying to sleep.
That'd be great.
Him and...
Let's get him and Goodman to reunite for one of those.
Well, like Goodman's like a house guest. And they're living in
He's the neighbor that they talk to. Like, yo, there's some crazy stuff going on here. Are you
Why don't
you
spend the night?
Right,
it's him on the... Goodman's on the couch. Denzel's in the bed.
Yes!
And like he has to have like a get Paula Patton back in there. He's been with Denzel a couple times. She's there too, and she like stands up in the middle of the night like they do in Paranormal, but like stands there for like 4 hours.
That's great. Yes, make it happen,
Denzel.
All your most of your budget's paying Denzel to
Denzel
be in the movie.
Denzel signs up for Paranormal Activity, the final activity. Blumhouse paid him a hefty sum.
The movie itself was budgeted at $300,000. Denzel was $10 million.
Making it the most costly Blumhouse effort yet.
Yeah. She's about to get... I think that, it's funny, there's people in this movie that play, you know, background people, and people that get touched real quick that I'm like, wait, I recognize that person from somewhere. Like this guy. What's his name?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He's in stuff.
Yeah. Well, it's the same as a lot of, you know, like these actors that, you know, like Gandolfini or whatnot, who start out as kind of bit players and then just rise up as character actors to a degree.
We love talking about character actors on Out Now with Aaron and Abe. We used to play many games focused around their roles and what have you, because they are to be well respected for all the many great performances they give, but don't get nearly enough credit for. Back to the commentary.
But I think there's like, yeah, there's another guy in this scene that I feel like I've seen somewhere too.
Well, that was, this guy's a speaking role, so it's like that's why you cast someone that has some kind of presence.
Right.
But yeah, no, you know, looking through this, no like horror in Washington's filmography here, besides, yeah, this movie to an extent and Bone Collector. Those are like the closest things.
You need to cap it off, make a trilogy of these. Here we go, the touching.
Well, it helps that, you know, he's a black actor. He's a superstar and a black actor, and black actors don't tend to have like these horror roots. Like Kevin Bacon, for example, in Friday the 13th or whatnot. Like, you have a lot of white actors in the 80s, which is generally where, you know, you have predominantly white casts in slasher movies or whatnot, and some of those, you know, actors would go on to be bigger and bigger stars. Like DiCaprio and like Critters 3.
Right.
Like things like that.
Yeah. I think you know, he had music beforehand, but, you know, LL Cool J doing H2O kind of launched him bigger into film and stuff. But, you know, like, he had his music.
Yeah, yeah.
And so.
Yeah. Along with that, yeah, that, yeah. And, you know, it's not like LL Cool J is a superstar actor. I mean, he's done films, and he has a very successful TV show with Chris O'Donnell, of course.
Right.
But, you know, look at, like, Denzel or Will Smith. Like, they're not actors that had to, like, you know, that thrived in horror to, you know, get their start or whatnot.
Right. Nobody, like, massive.
I'm trying to think of any. I can't, like, it, you know.
There's, like, what, Mekhi Phifer?
In what, Scream 2?
I Still Know What You Did Last Summer.
Oh, that was a banner year for Mekhi Phifer,
but
even that was, he had already gotten a start.
Yeah, Clocker.
Yeah, yeah, no, yeah, he, Clockers, High School High, Soul Food, yeah.
I'm trying to think. And then, you know, I like Mekhi Phifer. It ain't no movie if there's no Mekhi Phifer, but, like, it's, I'm trying to think of, you know, major black stars that.
Right, no, I don't think there's any.
Well, major. I think part of it is, you know, how many of those horror films had, say, more than one black character?
That's what I'm saying. Yeah,
place?
Like, you know, you get a, you know, quote unquote token black character in a lot of these, or, you know, minority character in a lot of these movies, but they don't tend to, you know, I don't find many of them.
They die first.
We don't find many of them as, you know, up and coming actors that became something huge.
Right. Miguel Nunez
Return of the Living Dead
was huge. Well, Return of the Living Dead, Friday the 13th, Part 5, would later go on to huge stardom with Juana Man.
Which was originally going to star Will Smith.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, there's...
What a world.
I mean, Tony Todd never launched his superstardom.
Well, he's, like, known for... He's known for horror, also, so it's like...
I mean, was Jada Pinkett doing anything before Demon Knight?
Set It Off.
Nutty Professor?
Okay. Was Nutty Professor right before Demon Knight?
No. Low Down Dirty Shame was her breakout.
Set It Off. That's right.
Yeah. Set It Off was 95. Low Down Dirty Shame was 94.
I mean, he had Apocalypse Now, but Lawrence Fishburne, I mean, his adult career,
well, he's
Nightmare on Elm Street 3.
He's done a lot of horror, Event Horizon, Predators.
Horizon,
yeah. You know, he's done thriller type stuff.
Ice Cube, Anaconda, right?
Well, he had Boys
true.
In the Hood and Friday. Like, he's Ice Cube. He's straight out of Compton. Like, he's already established himself. I'm trying to think of, like, you know, a huge black actor that, you know, got his start doing crappy horror movies or whatnot.
What did Idris Elba do? Probably just awesome plays. Yeah. That's how he does.
Idris Elba was in the Prom Night remake.
As one of his, you know, kind of, besides the, you know, The Wire, one of his first kind of big American movies is, would be the...
But Tyler Perry's Dirty Little Girls was the first time I had seen him. That was in 2007.
He was also Weeping with the Hillary Swank.
Yes.
Which is like this movie, essentially, with plagues and more swamp.
The Reaping was directed by Stephen Hopkins, and it is not a good movie.
Yeah, so I guess there are no black actors that, like, were Kevin Bacon's, you know, Jamie Lee Curtis's.
I'm trying to, like, that, this is, like, it's not bugging me, but it's like, now I need to, like, I don't want to, like, say that, like, be missing, like, some huge actor.
I mean, do we have any that even go on, like, a B-level of, like, a Linda Blair type fame? Like,
started out that way? I'm trying to think.
It started out like with like some big turn in a horror movie, but their career was kind of relegated to like, you know, B-level things. Or just stuck around in the genre. Yeah. It's...
What was Forrest Whitaker doing when he started? Fast Times at Ridgemont
High.
He
was in what? Species?
But yeah, he's already got like an Oscar nomination.
Yeah, he's already...
Like,
he's
he had Crying Game under his belt.
He's already... Right, yeah. I don't...
Yeah, Fast Times is, like, Forrest's first thing. What'd Jamie Foxx do? Booty Call's terrifying.
No. Oh. There's, what is it? Anthony Anderson, Urban Legend 2.
Feel free to email outnowpodcast@gmail.com if you have any suggestions for what we're trying to talk about and figure out the answer to here.
Well, the word is out on this, because now I'm curious if there actually is like a huge black actor that came up from doing like crappy horror movies as a start. That'll be a to be continued. But
did he find his brother yet?
No. I mean, his brother, his son punched him.
That's right.
Because he's been possessed.
That's right.
Yeah, here we go. This is like a big centerpiece scene in the movie, isn't it? Right here.
And again, it's subtle. You know, he possessed him, and he didn't like torture him or scald him or it just he hit him.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, enough.
This kid must have nailed the audition.
Yeah.
It's like, because this is just, you know, it's a nothing role, but it's like, we need a character that's like young, but like can still kind of like, you know, be creepy and like get on the nerve of Denzel. That's an actor too, right? That's like, that seems like a guy I could recognize.
Yeah.
I've seen that guy before. Yeah, this is the big scene right here because it's an action sequence, and then it like goes to that girl that's standing by over there, and she like blames Denzel for everything.
Right, and she was like her little line was like big part of the trailer.
Yeah, because I'm not finished having fun, something like that.
Right,
I'm still having too much fun.
Just like the. It kind of reminds me of the Joaquin Phoenix 8mm liner, like, dance with the devil. Devil don't change. The devil changes you.
See, I guess, you know, in a better movie, granted, again, we do like this movie, but in a better movie, you can feel more of Denzel's kind of like the struggle he's having with dealing with all of this, and you know, now he's having to kill a guy because of this thing.
But I don't know if the movie has aspirations to really delve that far into it, because it is, you know, at the end of the day, a B movie.
Yeah. Oh, it's basically, I mean, Azazel wants him to fry like he fried. But I don't know that he'd get put in the chair for one questionable shooting.
Well, he's trying to get him disgraced, I guess. He's trying to drive him mad, essentially. But he's dealing with Denzel Washington, who, you know, isn't one to go mad. So it's like he found himself in a pickle here.
Speaking of which, he's taking an awful risk. He's going to be able to touch somebody before he dies.
Well, he has, what, like a leap to find somebody? There's plenty of civilians standing around. I guess what's irritating is, you know, we as an audience, we get the rules faster than Denzel does. So it's like he's like still discovering that, like, just because I shoot this doesn't mean it goes away. It's like, we get it. Like, it just, you know, it travels all over the place.
Yeah, I guess there needs to be, I mean, one thing that could help is, like, this, maybe a more claustrophobic feel from Denzel about this whole thing. Rather than such an arrogant, there's a bit of an arrogance of this character to it, like,
well, like, yeah, like,
rather than a bit of a touch of insanity might have
like
helped.
Nick Cage, a little Nick Cage in his performance could have helped.
Someone kind of frazzled,
That's what I was saying, because Denzel is treating this, you know, he's dealing with literally a supernatural entity, but he's essentially dealing with like he knows how, a cop. But he is still treating a supernatural entity like a criminal that's on the loose somewhere.
Right. Yeah. His scenes with M. Beth Davids need to be a little bit more like frantic rather than just kind of taking it in, or just, you know, he needs to be going to her because he's losing his mind and she's the only person who knows, rather than just, you know, a cop collecting information. And Donald Sutherland returns.
His hair straighter than ever. In these big coats.
What's funny with him, like, Donald Sutherland's one of, like, to me, like, one of the, him and Elliot Gould are two of the, like, weirdest, like, male, like, sex icons of their decades. But, like, with him in this role, I'm like, I could see him. I could see him being that,
so
but
the stars of MASH.
Yeah.
You just don't
get. Yeah, I don't get, like, the just kind of weird looking dudes to be like, ooh, you know, it was a different era, and then, but like here, like him clean.
I could kind of get Elliot Gould a little more.
Yeah.
I can see,
but here I can see like this older dinosaur, and I could, like, oh, okay, I could. He looks kind of like a sharp old man here. Here, then I'm like, okay, a younger him.
He's got a strong jaw. I mean, I think that's where it comes down to. We're having some problems tonight with this recording. It's as if Azazel is really trying to mess with us as well, and all this stuff.
Time is not on our side.
No.
Yeah, sometimes Aaron sounds like you just smoke angel dust, PCP, crack.
But the filming of this commentary is insane. That's why I'll tell you that.
That's right.
Is this the first time Sutherland, Denzel, and John Goodman are all in the same scene together? And Gandolfini?
I think there's a police. I think he comes to him at their desk. Yeah, there's a police scene, I think.
With all of them in there? I'm surprised Dad.
And then maybe not in the same shot, but...
Okay. Okay, Michael Mann. Yeah, and now the news report's on, and it's like the girl's blaming him for the shoot.
Right.
Which is just, like, that's an impossible situation to be in.
Yeah.
It's like, it wasn't me, it was this demon.
But, I mean, there's the evidence of the guy, you know, being shot, him being shot at, but it was, like, blanks in the gun.
Yeah, it's like, makes it worse.
Azazel's a tricky little SOB.
Yeah.
Good time to mention that there's an Exorcist show adapted from the film coming to Fox. And it looks awful. Back to the commentary.
Yeah, things are just going awry for Denzel. He's about to spiral for him.
Well, this is it's the kind of annoying cliche of like a cop who's, you know, respected for what he does and has been able to take down so many things, and yet we can immediately turn on this person the second bad things start happening and believe no other alternative. Like, you know, Minority Report. That's my clearest example when that happens. Mm-hmm. He's like a fantastic officer who does everything he can and has this horrible backstory or whatnot, but like the second things start going bad, it's like, yep, he's definitely guilty, no question about it.
John Goodman burning the midnight oil.
It's raining again, by the way. It was like, it's completely dry outside when they're outside, so they're not adopting the whole wet the streets at night to make it look more cinematic tactic for some reason. But when they go inside the office, yeah, it is raining all the time.
Or someone's washing the windows constantly.
Yeah, that's probably it. It's probably on the first floor of a precinct. They're just always washing these windows. They get really dirty. Just like the city, which is covered in filth.
Right.
It's a motif they're going for.
It all looks like Azazel vision. Oh, there's a cigarette offer.
Okay, so we start this early.
There we go.
This is the climactic philosophical conversation.
This is our last good conversation between each other, right?
Yeah. He's about to go on the run, essentially.
It's 2 a.m., I must be lonely.
That's the kind of stuff Gandolfini listens to. Matchbox.
Yes.
He loves Rob Thomas. Huge Rob Thomas fan.
Every time he books someone, he thinks criminal. It's great.
Has Denzel done an animated movie? No, right?
I don't think so.
I see some like TV series thing, but yeah, I don't think he's done an animated movie.
No, yeah, no franchises, no animated. No superhero.
Not yet.
We'll see. He doesn't need to. I of all people out there, like I would say I could see Meryl Streep doing one before I see Denzel.
He turned down Furious 7, right? So.
Right. Yeah. Oh, he would have been cool in that.
Rumor has it he turned down Lex Luthor.
Hmm. Wow.
Well, you were close with Chiwetel Ejiofor then.
I'm sorry?
Well, you can't...
You were close with Chiwetel Ejiofor.
Yeah.
When you can't get Denzel, you go to, you know, Denzel Plan B, Jesse Eisenberg.
They both look good bald, so you know, that, they have that going for them. Well, yeah, because I really, like, I don't want there to be Equalizer 2. One, because I don't really like the Equalizer, but, like... Yeah,
it's got a good first act.
It does.
If they can make a full movie as good as that first act in Equalizer, I'm down.
Or just score it to Benny Hill music and keep doing the really crazy torture stuff in the third act.
Yeah.
Finale. But, like, I, you know, it's announced or whatnot, but, like, I'd like to see Denzel stick to his guns of not doing these, you know, not doing more of something.
I mean, well, even Bill Murray did Tale of Two Kitties. I mean,
well, he did Ghostbusters too.
Well, I mean, and I know I'm speaking out of turn here, but not out of turn, but you know, there aren't that many movies he's made that were necessarily sequel friendly. I mean, he dies at the end of Man on Fire.
But what if he didn't?
The implication is that he dies at the end of Man on Fire.
Well, I mean, the clear one that I thought of already, obviously, because of the books, is Devil in a Blue Dress.
Exactly. I think if that had been better,
Yeah.
And then we wouldn't be caring about the Equalizer 2 because that's just some other franchise. It'd be his, you know, Equalizer would be his Jack Reacher.
You could have Deja Vu 2, Deja Vu.
He dies in that one too, sort of.
Sort of, yeah, but he comes back. If Virtuosity was a better movie, you could easily make a more timely version of that movie again with him. The same.
Yeah,
Wait, does American he die in that too?
No, he doesn't die in Virtuosity.
Okay.
He saves the day. He kills evil Russell Crowe annoyed.
That's right. I about the entire film assumed he was going to die because he had nothing to live for.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, he starts in jail because he killed somebody in an accident or whatever. Yeah. See, Crimson Tide 2. Could do a sequel to that one. He's a new sub, and a young upstart played by Jesse Eisenberg challenges his authority. Dueling sequels to American Gangster and The Hurricane, The After Jail Years.
Ooh.
Or He Got Game, also. A lot of Denzel coming out of jail in movies, by the way. I've just named four movies where he comes out of jail at the end of them.
the Greater Debaters.
The Greater Debaters, yep. Flight 2.
Flights.
Red Eye. Flights, yes. He rolls two planes. Two Guns, Too Furious.
Stand By, Flight 2.
And Two Guns is based on a comic, so that, you know, that lends itself to it. Yeah. But yeah, I know what you're saying, so obviously, yes. The movies, especially ones where, you know, it's the Denzel show, they don't really lend themselves to more.
They were going to do a sequel to Inside Man.
Yeah, they were talking about that for
a while. Yeah, they were talking about that for a while.
But, he until his brand proves bad that he would need to, which it never has, he's been solid.
Yeah.
Throughout.
In his quote-unquote prime years, 2004, mid-90s to late 2000s or whatever. I'm not that he's not prime now, but, a sequel wasn't the immediate goal.
Yeah.
I mean, you had a mindset of, an example that always comes to mind is, Chris Farley and David Spade do well with Tommy Boy. So instead of making Tommy Boy 2, they make Black Sheep.
Well, that's Bingo. The same as, every Apatow and Adam McKay movie. Like, they're not making sequels to these, save for Anchorman 2, and apparently
that's the problem with the Hangover movies. You should have just done same guys and director and do a different movie.
Yeah.
That's a Warner Brothers problem more than a...
Well, to be fair, the Hangover 2 made, $500 million.
Yeah, it made its money. But obviously...
Even Part 3 did $330-ish.
You say Denzel, prime Denzel 90s to 2000, but his openings since Man on Fire have been great.
Oh, no, that's what I'm saying. I clarified that because you're right. I was,
they've only gotten
The Equalizer, I think, is his best solo opening.
Yeah. And I remember Safe House was a record too for him, right?
Yeah. That was 40.
And so
American Gangster is his biggest opening.
Yes, yeah. Well, that was a big him and Russell Crowe in a giant Ridley Scott movie casting, all of us are in that movie. Everybody's in that movie.
Yes. I spent a weekend.
Yeah.
and I've also been cast in Spider-Man Homecoming, so that'll be fun.
Oh, yeah.
I heard that.
Yeah, you play an assistant PE teacher.
Yes.
I'm still young enough. I play one of the seniors. I look young enough. I play one of the seniors in high school.
Scott's character might be the Scorpion.
Yeah.
might.
Here comes the moment I was talking about earlier where I said one of my favorite Denzel moments is his reaction when he feels his brother's dead. He takes this breath. It's just I don't know. I felt really bummed and stuff. Yeah, it is. Where he realizes, his fate. But, I don't know. Every time I see this movie, I just feel really sad at this point. It's all on Denzel.
Well, it feels like this inevitable moment. He kind of half knew this was coming.
And Denzel knows how to sell a death scene. He can't make this work. He's not pulling a glory tier right here, but he's certainly coming close.
Yeah, man, it's a great moment.
There's a lot. There's a lot there because his brother just died. The son's in the other room. He has to he's thinking on his feet of how to handle this. He's very sad. There's a lot of things he gets to play off of, and that's where Denzel works best because the rest of the movie or a lot of the movie doesn't give him a whole lot. It's just be determined to do this thing. Here's a scene where he actually has to play with his emotions because there's no other real emotional sequences in this movie besides maybe
he's on the cusp of being defeated.
Yeah,
and.
Besides, shooting Donald Sutherland, having to choose between shooting Donald Sutherland or John Goodman, this is a scene where he has to really, do something different.
Which sucks because he's going to leave.
There's a glory yep. here. Never mind.
Which sucks is he's going to leave behind a nephew and not raise him, but... Azazel.
Well, I mean, he does try to beat Azazel and would likely get back to the sun. Or no, isn't he's just killing himself.
Yeah.
Never mind. What am I talking about?
Yeah,
he kills himself regardless. Yeah.
Right.
He's just trying to win. Magnificent Seven could lead to sequels. I mean, they made more of those movies.
Right. Safer Houses.
Safer Houses. He dies in that one, too, doesn't he?
yes.
Doesn't he die in that one? I think he dies in that one.
He does.
Safe House is 2012. When was Scream 4?
2011.
Was that 11? Yeah. Okay.
That was random.
I was thinking of when we started this podcast and when I started hearing...
Oh, fair enough.
When I started hearing you more on things, I was like, I gotta get Scott on this podcast.
Harry Potter.
Yeah, Harry Potter was the first one, and I think it's because you were on the Slash Filmcast for Scream 4. That's what I was like.
Yeah.
I gotta hear more of this Scott character.
Could have a...
I think Safe House is like one of your last times on the Slash Filmcast, too.
Born Legacy.
Born Legacy. There you go. Okay.
Oh. You are on for the gems.
Excuse me.
We could have a He Still Got Game. John R.
You'd have a sequel to the Book of Eli, the Prelude of Eli.
Prelude of...
The novella of Eli.
Dies in that one, too.
Yep. No, that's why it'd be a prequel.
Oh.
Denzel dies in a lot of movies, by the way.
He and Bruce Willis die a lot.
He, Bruce Willis, and DiCaprio. DiCaprio dies in a surprise in a lot of movies.
You know, oddly enough, they could do... VR's coming back, so they could do Virtuosity... Two.
That's what I was saying. I was saying that if Virtuosity was a better movie, they could have made that again with a more like timely version of it.
They could do The Siege 2 Dark Territory.
The Siege 2 Today's Politics.
Yes.
The Preacher's Husband.
Back in Time.
Back in Time.
It's a really boring office drama. Just, everything goes the way it should happen.
Taking a Pelham 456.
The Preacher's Husband.
Yep.
Wait, what?
Wait a minute.
Pittsburgh. Here we go. See, here's Denzel asking what apocalypse means. It's like, what?
You mean like the book of the Bible? I know Revelation, but I don't know Apocalypse.
Like, that's such an odd question for anyone to ever have to ask. What's Apocalypse? Like, the word Apocalypse sounds like its definition, Apocalypse.
It's an onomatopoeia.
Exactly.
I mean, Apocalypse Now?
The basic definition of Apocalypse would be Apocalypse. Like...
Well, you mean that apocalypse? Okay. Mm.
I thought it was just a cool word of syllables.
While Denzel questioning the apocalypse is mystifying, he does often say the phrase, "Tell this to me like I am a fourth grader," or some variation. He does look like getting the various forms of information.
I just wanted to get your autograph. You caught that serial killer.
I'm not Azazel.
I don't know if Denzel's best plan was to punch out an officer. I don't know if that was the best way to handle a situation.
Right. I mean, this—you know what? This movie's also mixing around with the time of like where we had movies like Stigmata and End of Days.
End of Days, yeah.
Not highly recommended movies, but
no.
But you could lump it in with those. Dealing with like religious things,
was
and then
Y2K fear, or just
I think that has to be part of it, right? That the kind of
you know, when these movies are coming out or whatnot, there's this kind of like theme of the end of things going on, and like dealing with the idea that the world could be corrupted because of a sign of the end of times.
Because
being
of
embodied by a year, by, you know,
a made up calendar hitting triple zeros.
Yeah. Well, just I can see, you know, various, and you know, there obviously there have been some sects of religion that really thought that the end of the world was coming when the year 2000, but it's, you know, a new millennia, like
a new millennium.
Yes.
I have to wonder if they had sold this more as an explicitly religious thriller, if it might have done better. Because, obviously, clearly there are religious overtones, but there's not a lot of, you know, nobody gets crucified in this film, for example. You know, there's not a lot of, you know, stereotypical religious imagery that would play to the audience that, you know, gave The Haunting of Emily Rose a $33 million opening weekend in 2005, or gave Stigmata a $19 million opening weekend in 1999.
The Exorcism of Emily Rose.
I'm sorry, what did I say?
The Haunting of Emily Rose.
Thank you.
There's another one, right? The Haunting of something else.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. It's a pretty generic title placement. The Haunting of this person, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, no, we already talked about the kind of the level of violence in this movie. It doesn't really have anything to sell itself on beyond Denzel Washington and a bunch of character actors in a movie about this thing that kind of, you know, dances around you.
It's kind of procedural. It's kind of religious, end of the world thriller.
Like, there's a lot of like hot buttons it's trying to press, but it doesn't really press them very hard.
It's the new Denzel movie when the new Denzel movie was just becoming a thing.
But it's also coming out Martin Luther King Day weekend, which, you know, not a bad time to open a film. But at the same time, there's all these prestige movies out. Titanic's still destroying everything.
Right.
The success of Titanic was something that was unheard of and remains to be something that has rarely been matched by anything that's not directed by James Cameron.
I want to hear more about Sam.
Oh.
Yeah, no epics for Denzel yet. Except Much Ado About Nothing, obviously.
He's got his own little career. I mean,
I think especially because he wants to, you know, Fences is exactly, you know, that's going to be his third directed movie, right? Third?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What am I thinking of? Great Debaters and, Antoine
Fisher.
Yeah.
Which is awesome.
But, you know, he's obviously not being, he's not too prolific so far in his directing, but it certainly seems like something that he wants to do more. Like, in addition to Fences, he's doing a lot of these, of the August Wilson plays, not necessarily all as a film, but is he doing some of them HBO or something? Isn't that the thing?
I do not know.
He has his hand on all these August Wilson screenplays, and I'm not sure if they're all going to be filmed or whatnot, but I just know he's going to be directing a lot of them in some form. But yeah, Fences is obviously, you know, that's going to be a release of some kind. A major, you know, a theatrical release, but that, you know, that takes time. That probably, you know, pushes them away from you know, needing any kind of reason to engage in superhero fare or, you know, big action franchise fare. Which, you know, good on him, because it's not like he has anything to prove.
Yeah,
right. And he doesn't really go after like, oh, I'm working with, you know, big name director. He sticks to like Fuqua, Spike Lee, and did work with like Tony Scott a bunch, but like he doesn't.
Yeah, he's not like Tom Cruise, you know.
Right,
Who, like, you know, really finds... Well, Tom Cruise and Christopher McQuarrie seem to be besties forever, but it's not like... it's not like Denzel's going out of his way to find, like, the hot coming talent or what have you.
Even known entities. Like, he's not...
Yeah, it's more of like he's worked with Edward Zwick a couple times. He's worked with Tony Scott, like you said, a bunch of times. Like, he's worked with a lot of the same directors or ones that, you know how to... That he's, you know, he's confident with, as opposed to finding new teammates. Actors, on the other hand, though, he's, you know, he's big on, you know, kind of bringing in other, you know, young casts.
like young upcoming black talent, especially. Like you look at like something like Inside Man, where Chiwetel Ejiofor's cover, or America Gangster, where you know, like everybody's in that movie. like I said earlier, but like a lot of like Idris Elba's in that movie, Chiwetel's in that movie, RZA's in that movie. Like there's a lot.
Of, yeah. I mean, that's him. Yeah, he's going for you know, like he went with Ridley Scott there, but I mean, I don't. It's like, you know, he worked with his brother a lot, so I could, you know, see that happen. But, yeah, he's, I mean, he's not chasing, like, oh, I need to be in a Scorsese movie before I'm done, or I need to be, you know, chased after, like, Spielberg and stuff, which a lot of actors seem to want to get, you know, chased after that. And he's just really unique, as much as, like, you know, prestige and, like, oh, it's Denzel, he's really a very unique.
And, you know, even the, you know, the stuff he chooses, it's not like it's inherently a box office draw. Like, it's not like, Scott, we've talked about before with, like, Will Smith and more recently The Rock, where he's choosing genres that he can fit into and enhance to make, like, a giant movie out of. It's more of stuff, Denzel's comfortable with stuff he can perform because he, you know, he's an actor that wants to, you know, work with stuff like that, but not things that necessarily need to, you know, bring in a massive audience or whatever for solely the purpose of that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he's one of the few outright I make my own star vehicles where I'm the main attraction once we have left. Other than, you know, obviously Leonardo DiCaprio is the you know, the biggest of the big in that realm.
And most people like that do that, like, aren't like big box office draws or star in the mainstream stuff like he does. Like you get stuck in like art house fare doing a lot of that kind of stuff, like a Joaquin Phoenix type person that stays away from that kind of stuff. But yeah, I mean, Joaquin Phoenix has done epic. He did Gladiator, but like he kind of stays away from that stuff. But you wouldn't, I mean, people don't line up for the new Joaquin Phoenix movie.
I do like that this like back half of the movie has Denzel act every like religious item he sees. It's as if he's seen something like this for the first time. Like that's his reaction.
It is all around. Did you know if you put two pieces of wood together, it make a cross?
Denzel would be great in a vampire movie.
Oh, give it to me. Yes.
Understanding all this for the first time.
Long drive out to the cabin in the woods.
Back out to the cabin in the woods. And yeah, we're getting that narration again, which is, you know, again, it's playing it pretty well as far as what it's trying to establish.
I guess the narration sort of gives it a bit of a rewatch value if you want to go back and see how consistent or in line with what it's trying to do it is. Huh. I'm not there yet, actually.
That's a sad state of affairs, by the way, for, you know, like a hotshot cop to have to resign to, you know, murdering himself in order to get the better of some kind of supernatural force that's out there.
Well, he's already kind of screwed in the public eye, and there's no one's going to believe his story.
I mean, if he sat everyone down and explained how he just learned about what apocalypse means, that might have helped.
Right.
The finale of this film is quite clever as far as what it tries to establish, and certainly a reason why I like coming back to this film. Fallen may not be a fantastic film, but it is one that challenges some ideas of what's expected from a police procedural.
And now we're in our climax here. Very moody, as usual, for this movie.
This couldn't happen in daytime.
It's a long drive, so.
It's a good set. Like, I wonder if the movie worked back. This seems like a movie that worked backwards, right? Like, as far as, like, setting up a story.
Like, someone had...
Like, maybe it had the idea of, having a spirit that could transfer itself from person to person, and then probably wrote out the ending first, as far as, like, the trick it plays on the audience of, like, allowing you to think that it's one way and then turning the other way, and then maybe went from there.
Yeah, I could see that.
You know?
The narrative trickery.
Yeah, the narrative, but this is, like, because this, like, whole climax, aside from, we need to have a gunfight for whatever reason, it's a good, like, it's a good, like, way to play it with having these characters that you've established and, like, having them confront each other in some way. It's, like, that's exciting, like, because you don't know how things are going to play out exactly.
Plenty of Denzel Washington films have misdirects in some way, as he has had a long career full of many different challenging films. One to seek out, of course, is one of his most popular hits, Inside Man, directed by Spike Lee.
Yeah, besides the narration, this is probably the loosest Denzel is, right? Where he breaks a bit. It's like in, John Wick, where Keanu finally, like, he gives that, people keep telling me I'm coming back. Well, I am back. He's just kind of like gets a lot more fun for a second.
It's part of the misdirect in that this vocalization is closer in line to the voiceover, which just, continues the notion that he, wins at the end.
Now we're all thinking, oh, it's Donald Sutherland, for sure.
Because he looks so evil the entire film. He really does.
Because he was once possessed and pointed a finger at somebody.
Donald Sutherland tends to, if he's not smiling, he looks evil. Like, that's Donald Sutherland in a nutshell right there.
Yeah, he's up to something.
yeah, exactly. Straight-faced Donald Sutherland does not look like a fun guy.
Yeah. He's just got these eyes. It's like, I don't want to get in the car with you, no.
Well, he has piercing blue eyes and a long face. Oh, Gandolfini survives.
Yeah.
I always forget that he doesn't die at some point in this movie.
Well, after these events, him and his sister quit the force and moved to Jersey.
Yeah, they woke up one morning.
Yes.
And just,
he already had the gun, but he got himself one. The famous he is the traitor scene.
I guess part, that's why you get Denzel, by the way, because you don't have any reason to not believe Denzel would win how the movie starts and just the nature of it's Denzel. Of course he wins.
Yeah.
And also, because he's Denzel, he's not crazy.
Yeah. Right.
I like The Fugitive as much as everybody else, but, when you cast someone like Harrison Ford, you do lose a certain, maybe he really did kill his wife. It's Harrison Ford. Of course he didn't kill his wife.
Well, I mean, that's a remake of a TV show where he's innocent, though.
Well, yeah.
In the show, for at least the first couple episodes, it wasn't so much doubt, but they had a weird marriage.
He was rich. It
was a creepy relationship.
And she was more rich. So.
Yeah.
The other big thing in the 90s is Michael Douglas gets into some like crazy shit involving his ex-wife or something like that.
Oh yeah,
right. Yeah,
that seemed to be a huge thing in the 90s. I saw what's it called? What's the one with him and Viggo Mortensen?
Perfect Murder.
That was on HBO. That I watched that for like 20 minutes. It's like, oh yeah, this is Michael. This is the Michael Douglas I'm more familiar with.
Yeah.
Him trying to tough talk his way out of terrible situations. Oh God.
And this reveal did surprise me. Not the reveal, but the
way it happens.
Yeah.
It's a shot kill. Like.
Yeah, Goodman just turns on a dime. It's Did you guys like him in Cloverfield Lane?
Oh yeah,
very much.
Yeah, he's pretty good playing a villain.
I don't need to buy into Oscar talk for movies released in February or March or whatever, but
right.
But he's really good in it.
No,
it was the kind of thing that made me look back and think, why hasn't he been nominated for anything before besides Roseanne Emmys?
Yeah. I mean, he's been great in some Coen Brothers movies that he could have probably gotten some notice for.
He's the kind of actor that's like due for some kind of like veteran nod at some point.
Yeah.
Right.
If he's in the right thing at the right time kind of thing. You know, if Flight didn't suck. But,
yeah. I didn't like the Kevin Smith movie Red State, but he was quite good in it.
Oh yeah, he's good.
Yes.
Because Goodman's not bad in anything, I don't think. I'm trying to think of anything that he's like legit.
The only
not.
Thing I can think of where he was bad is that 1 2-part Studio 60 in the Sunset Strip episode.
Oh, okay.
Where he played the stereotypical Southern judge or whatever.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it wasn't his fault, it was an atrocious two episodes.
Of that classic series that lasted forever.
Yes.
That was the last. That was like NBC's big
failure.
That was
the Briscoe County Jr. of that time.
That was the beginning of NBC falling out of, like, you know, prestige.
Yeah.
Because they, you know, gambled on that show huge.
I guess.
Yeah, it was a year nothing went right for that. It was like that, Friday Night Lights, and there was like another show, and they just all didn't. They had Heroes, which was their surprise. But then that fell off like right away in the subsequent seasons. But yeah, that was NBC's fall.
I guess if Inside Llewyn Davis was like more prosperous in its, which was in a pretty good year, so it's like hard for it to also, you know, be among them. But you could have got like a supporting thing for that role.
Yeah.
It's like loud enough and broad enough just to be like, here's like, you know, a general supporting actor type of thing. In addition to being like a career type Oscar. But again, 2013, there's a lot of things going on, so.
Yeah.
And who went supporting that year?
Waltz, I believe, and Django, right?
Right.
Yeah, Django, yeah.
No, wait.
No, that's 12. That's
no, 2012. That was 2012.
What's 2013 Oscars?
Is it Jared Leto?
What's the best picture?
Yeah, it's Jared Leto.
Jared Leto.
God, that damn Joker. Yeah. And Argo is like a roll of the dice of who gets a supporting actor nod. They gave it to Arkin.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
There's like so many like supporting performances that I probably could have got some.
Denzel Washington is, of course, a 2-time Oscar winner, winning a Best Supporting Actor for Glory and a Best Actor trophy for Training Day. He's also been nominated numerous times, including his work in Flight and The Hurricane.
And yeah, now he's going to take himself out, which is, like, sad.
Right. Yeah. Smoking a poison cigarette. Well, I like his plan of letting, you know, him slowly die.
Yeah.
And he's injured enough he can't crawl over to touch him. He's got like one good lunge in him, probably. Oh, Speed Racer, John Goodman.
Yep.
Yeah.
Pops Racer.
Yeah. He was 80. I mean,
more like a
every adult actor in that movie got one terrific speech.
Yep.
And just a lot of fun things to do.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's awesome.
Yeah, the movie's great.
And deserves a 3D IMAX re-release.
4K UHD, bring it.
Oh, God. The colors.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and he had the Bringing Out the Dead, too. That was...
Well, that's vastly underrated.
Very
underrated. It's actually one of my favorite
Scorsese's. Yeah. Very underrated Scorsese film.
Does Sutherland have Oscar nods?
he have anything?
I'm sure he did. He have Clute? Did he? That movie got.
Yeah.
Yeah. Geez, Goodman works. He's got a ton of credits. He's had, you know, he's had multiple TV, shows. He does a lot of guest TV spot stuff. He's busy.
Hosted SNL like all the time in the 90s.
Is he in the Five Timers Club?
I don't know. I think so.
Probably,
what,
right?
SNL?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's one of the most. Yeah, he's like
he's
top
one of the most, right?
Three, yeah.
I remember he did a promo. It was plugging Monsters, Inc., so he hosted, and this was, of course, right after 9/11, and the promo was basically, everyone's saying that we should all go back to what we're doing every day, and I host Saturday Night Live every day.
No Oscars for Sutherland.
No nominations.
Yeah, just a lot of Golden Globe stuff.
And he had a Saturn.
And a couple
a nomination for... Yeah, weird.
An MTV Movie Award nomination. So, you know, that probably pushed him up a notch.
Well, that probably took the sting out of never being nominated for an Academy Award way right off the bat.
Any second now, it should be a generational award for him on the MTV Movie Awards.
Yeah.
What was he nominated for the MTV Movie Awards?
Probably Hunger Games.
Yeah, Hunger Games.
Oh, yes. Sutherland. Okay, I'm sorry.
Sutherland, yeah. Goodman. Okay. I'll look at that next, if Goodman has any MTV Movie Awards. Did he get over 10 Cloverfield Lane? He had to, right?
They have the MTV Movie Awards every 3 months, right? That's...
Nope, John Goodman has no MTV Movie Award nominations. Outrageous.
Nobody appreciates the babe.
I mean, that predated the MTV Movie Awards, so that probably would have gotten him one. So that we'll just go with that. He was just off by a couple years.
Now, what prevented Hobbs from just shooting himself after he killed Goodman?
Pride.
Yeah. Slow there poison rather than bullet.
Pride and ego. Although, yeah, that, I wonder that too, because I probably, if I was in his, if I'm killing myself, I probably, you know, I wouldn't even want to be a part of that world. It'd be like if you're trying to be, if you're like someone's trying to turn you into a zombie, you don't even want to become a zombie, you just want to die.
James Gandolfini also has not been nominated for MTV Movie Award.
He'll get his chance.
Oh,
that's the darkest joke.
That's a cookie for those that stayed through with us through the whole thing.
The whole thing of this very soul and fallen commentary that livelyly ends on the sympathy for the devil.
Throwback to Darkman.
Throwback for Darkman. The songs a throwback to the Ichabod Crane cast, of course.
Yep. This movie ends how the Ichabod Crane cast began.
Exactly. So, you know, it does lead itself to a sequel called Azazel.
Yeah.
If this movie was more successful, it could have had direct-to-video spinoffs.
It was Universal. Probably would have.
It was Warner Brothers.
Yep.
Azazel's song in the next one is Satisfaction.
Then Street Fighting Man. That's Fallen. Oh, the credits are fun. You get some symbols in the credits, too. So that's a very dark ending for this movie, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
The music's kind of cheery or whatnot. But I mean, you know, all the three lead characters die.
You lose, Hobbs.
The multiple innocents die, and the villain gets away.
Yeah.
You can kind of see why it doesn't make that much money, then, I guess, if you think about it.
Leave the movie going, well, I feel good. Yeah, Azazel do? Just, like, hang out now? You know, Azazel's done antagonizing.
It's the same as Tom Cruise in Vampire. In Interview with a Vampire. He just kind of hangs out. Rides around in an automobile. No, he's probably, he finds a reporter to tell a story to, right? He's narrating that whole thing. He's writing a book. That's what it is.
There you go.
He's writing the time Denzel almost beat me.
He's going to give them a choice he never had.
It'll be from the writer of Will Ferrell's Matt Lauer Can Suck It in Land of the Lost.
Sadly, more timely than ever.
Yeah. Oh, this is 90, so the cast credits are coming up just now. All right, well, by the way, Donald Sutherland's wardrobe was provided courtesy of, I can't read that text, it's too small. But he had a special credit for his costume design, so Donald Sutherland, that's what he got paid for, costumes. We've been talking about Fallen. Happy for everyone that stuck around to listen to all of what we had to say about Fallen, which mostly concerned things that Denzel Washington did, which is, you know, pretty much fun to talk about in general. But before, I guess, we go here, where can people find everyone's work online? Brandon?
You can find my written work over at whysoblue.com and listen to Cult Cinema Cavalcade. Current episode is discussing the film Trancers with Jason Coleman of Flixer Fans and Why So Blue. And you can find that at cultcinemacavalcade.com and on Twitter at cccavalcade.
Trancers. Scott Mendelson.
Forbes. Forbes.com, the ticket booth. Twitter at Scott Mendelson. Facebook, yada, yada, yada.
Great. You can find me over at thecodeofzeke.com. You can find me on Twitter at Aaron's PS4. You can find all the other episodes of Out Now with Aaron and Abe over on iTunes and Audioboom. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, Out Now Podcasts, and at Out Now _ Podcasts. Yeah, find all our regular episodes throughout, you know, the week and everything. We'll be back next month with another commentary. No, next month. Well, we'll have a commentary probably, but next month's October, which means that Brandon, among others, will be joining us to have all kinds of crazy horror bonus episodes, so that should be a lot of fun.
I like the scaries.
You like the scaries. And so that's going to do it for this week's bonus commentary track. So until next time, so long and goodbye.